Hi, this is Jeff Chrysler. You're about to listen to a special episode of Cheater and the Rude, where Tony Hendra of The Final Edition is interviewed by and interviews Ellen Stein, author of That's Not Funny, That's Sick. I hope you enjoy.
We have with us today Ellen Stein, who is the author or authoress of the latest lampoon and possibly most definitive lampoon book, That's Not Funny, That's Sick. And I am possibly going to interview Ellen Stein, or possibly Ellen Stein's going to interview me, which she never did for this book, even though I was at the Lampoon.
Ah, I can explain why.
Okay.
You were busy finishing your book.
Right.
Going Too Far, available at all good bookstores. And so you didn't want to be interviewed for the book.
That's absolutely true. And I
would have loved to have had you.
I was trying to get away with it, but obviously I can't. Speaking of that, actually, I was kind of one of the tiny bones I have to pick with you.
Oh no!
Is that you called Going Too Far a memoir in the credits. My credits.
This is the epilogue.
Yes, right. Which was not really the case. It was really a history.
It's a survey with a personal experience angle.
Yeah, but I mean, really, it was. Yeah. I think probably still the only history of that particular aspect of American culture, post-war American culture. Going Too Far was a history of black or whatever you want to call it, sick humor. As it was between the 1950s and the 1980s. So, but anyway, let's talk about your book and
not a memoir.
Not a memoir. I must say, one of the things and you jump in and start interviewing me because
okay.
You know anytime you want. But one of the things I do just want to say to our listeners is that there have been several books about the National Lampoon, and most of them follow the same rough chronology that I established in Going Too Far, which was the first account of the National Lampoon from 1970 to its to the beginning of its decline in the early 80s, and most of them have also tended to focus on the various peccadilloes and quarrels and feuds and so on of the Lampoon with a kind of relish that seems completely out of place for a magazine that that's now 40 years old and as if people were really interested in why Doug Kenny went to stay in Martha's Vineyard and do a lot of drugs, but Ellen's is most in fact Ellen I should say it to you. I mean, what really impresses me about the book is that you've set the Lampoon in its historical context, and not only that, but you finally, I mean, I think there have been sort of hints of this earlier, but finally you set the Lampoon down as an enormous influence on American comedy in the latter half of the 20th century.
Well, one thing, I mean, the internal dynamics are there because you have to explain, why things evolved the way they did. But what was really interesting to me is the context, the larger context, and also, I mean, so much of the material stands up. Because one of the reasons I looked at it from 1970 to 1980 was because that's when it was in its heyday, and after that it became a product as opposed to sort of more creative expression that for
right.
some just managed to various reasons, which I hope I outline, become commercial by sheer luck almost. But it's a way of looking at the '70s, which is very often dismissed as disco swinging and oil crisis, that's it, and avocado bathroom sweets, that's it.
And self-indulgence and the me decade and
the
all,
me
that,
decade,
all that stuff.
And that
right.
sort of swinging.
Right. which I think actually I've always felt, well, obviously I have certain vested interest in this, but I mean, I've always felt the 70s actually were a period of great sort of opening up.
That's what I was about to say. I was really looking at how the 60s turned into the 80s, and a lot of the sort of fault lines in culture and politics that we're still arguing about now started then. And the Lampoon, you know, without waving a flag on one side or the other, explored these. And so a lot of the material, which stands up incredibly well. You know, I mean, I was looking at that. There was that piece in the politics issue about ultra-right. Where's this here? Mediocre. It was a parody of the ultra-right commercial, and it had Nelson Rockefeller, of course, was the now deceased Reed, the liberal Republican or moderate Republican, saying, "One day I overheard a top leader in my party. You wouldn't know his name in a million years, but he's on the board of 147 top corporations. Say to a mediocre party warhorse, 'Too bad Nelson's such a goddamn pinko. What do you say we give him the old heave-ho?' He recommended ultra-right. All it is a powerful mixture of blatant racism and crude fear enhancers combined with simple-minded rhetoric. In just weeks, convictions I had held for 20 years were gone, and with them that low-key washed-up feeling that could accompany defeat in a major election." So I was editing this book for publication during the primaries in 2012.
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah.
And, you know,
nothing's happened since 1972.
Could have come right out of his candidate's mouth, I thought.
Yes, yes, absolutely. No, I mean, I think that's very much the case. And I mean, in the sense that people seem to have forgotten that, for example, the 70s were the absolute, probably the best period that Hollywood ever went through. I mean, 70s movies, well, I think 70s, one of them, but I mean, certainly far better than the 60s and far better than the 80s. I mean, wonderful movies were made in the 70s, and not just the obvious ones like Godfather. So, I mean, the culture as a whole gets very short-changed.
We'll make an exception for Spinal Tap in the 80s, of course.
Right. Oh, another movie you didn't actually talk about very much.
I mentioned it, but it's sort of out of the... I really had to be disciplined about stopping at 1980 because that book is long enough.
Yes, yes, indeed.
It could be a whole other book. So.
But I mean, now that we're together, I mean, actually, it seems to me Spinal Tap, not only in terms of personnel, but in terms of sort of continuation of things that the Lampoon obviously explored first, like rock parody, was an outgrowth of it just as much as Saturday Night Live.
It's a whole other book.
Yeah. That's an idea.
Not just a footnote.
Maybe we should do it together.
Not just a tiny, you know, sort of tiny couple of paragraphs in mine, but a whole other thing unto itself. But I wanted to ask you, I mean, you have, you know, been working at the satire coalface Man and Boy.
Right.
And do you think its audience has gotten bigger? I mean, you know, I get memes on Facebook every day. They're actually quite pointed and good. And has the audience gotten bigger, but has it gotten more diffuse and it's even less relevant? Or is it more, The Daily Show, you know, is it more relevant? You've got this. So, I mean, what do you think?
Well, actually, I mean, I tend to be a little bit of a fundamentalist about satire when it comes to the definition of satire, but because I think satire is a timeless form, which needs to be properly defined, and without getting into that right now, because that's kind of boring and academic, I think there are many different things that pass for satire but have satirical intention. So, for example, I would describe my great friend and I think comedic genius George Carlin as a satirist in just the same way that Juvenal was a satirist. I mean, the way that the sort of slashing surveys of his, you know, contemporaneous life are sort of satirical in the most ancient sense. But I think a lot of things pass as satire, but have the effect that satire ought to have. So, I mean, it seems to me that in the 2008 election, and actually in the last election, the presidential election, I mean, Tina Fey and what she did to Sarah Palin was classic satire in action. I mean, that is exactly what satire should do, and it affected the outcome of the election, no question.
Yeah.
I wrote a long essay at the time for some academic journal, a right-wing one, actually, called Keene Magazine, with Keene University in New Jersey. But it was about the fact that Obama seemed to be, even more than Reagan, completely unassailable. And it wasn't just that he was African-American and that people were nervous about it, but he didn't give them any edge to peel up. Whereas the McCain and Palin were just insane. I mean, and you cannot, ultimately, you cannot get elected when almost everything you say has a laugh track applied to it, you know. And the same thing was true. Well, I think
I hope you're right.
It's the same thing was true in 2011. I mean, the Republicans shot themselves in the foot by being so ludicrous. I mean, it was very hard to keep up with them.
Well, it depends on your point of view. Ludicrous to those of us in the Senate, you know, rational-based community, but, you know, not ludicrous to...
Yeah, but I think fairly ludicrous...
people who voted for them, I'm afraid.
Yeah, but I think fairly ludicrous to the center. I mean, if you look...
the reality-based community.
But, I mean, that's an interesting point in general, because I do think that satire, which I define as something much more like... Colbert, to me, is much more of a satirist than Stewart, because he adopts the position and mentality of his enemy, of his target. And that's really what great satire does. It's what Jonathan Swift does. That's what Dr. Strangelove does. I mean, all the great sort of high points of satire that we know of do that. And to me, that's the most admirable when you can do that.
Mm. Okay. The other thing is, I mean, I do spend a lot of time in the book on a couple of your post-Lampoon projects, which I thought, well, you know, in a way, not the New York Times had even more of an impact than a lot of Lampoon articles.
Yes, I must thank you for that. I've tended to be kind of mushed into the general, it was all such fun. And it was an incredibly difficult thing to do. Mm. And it did actually, after all the experience I had at the Lampoon as an editor, for which I also thank you, because that was really what I was very good at. I was not a bad writer, but I was really good editor, and I collaborated really well with people. So this was my opportunity to sort of shine as Rusty Younger said, as the editor in chief.
Yeah.
And it was God, it was exciting. It was such fun too.
It was funny.
Oh, it was very funny. I mean, I still go back and read Carl Bernstein of all people. You know. Pope dies yet again. Rain is briefest ever. Cardinals return from airport. I mean, that was George Plimpton. He and I wrote that headline together at 3 o'clock in the morning.
And also, the lifestyle section was what really cracked me up. The funniest headline was, "Cocaine in quotes, a drug appears popular."
Right.
That's the New York Times to a T right there.
Right, and then they had the graphic of the increasing number of noses from 1978, whatever it was. You know.
The other thing is that I spent a lot of time on because I thought it was very interesting. Because one thing I wanted to use the book to do is to – it isn't a soup-to-nuts history of Lampoon. Like I said, it starts
not at all,
then, ends in 1980. All these people who like really liked it in 1980 have written in saying, wait, we didn't do this and that. Different book. But I also wanted to use it to sort of shine a light on some other things that were happening that were related, maybe tangentially related, or that Lampoon people worked on, or that fed into Lampoon in some way, that have, I think, been forgotten to some extent, and some extent unfairly forgotten, like TV, which I always thought was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very influential in a very sort of subtle way, but it was hugely. This was a sort of a forerunner of Michael Moore, only I think better, were a combination of documentary filmmaking and satire. And, you know, Bill Murray worked on it, and Christopher Guest again, and all sorts of people. But
it was very, very much a kind of guerrilla TV before that term.
Exactly. And all the theories, and at one point Michael Schamberg, who has gone on to be a very successful Hollywood producer, but then was working with this guerrilla television group, said that, you know, it's not enough to change the means of production. We have to change the means of distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it happened 20, 30 years later, but it didn't make a big difference. But the other thing that I wanted to sort of, that I spent a lot of time on, because I liked it, so is the 80s, a look back. And that, so many of those, especially Jeff Greenfield, so many of those articles are so prescient, like the one about the Supreme Court, A Court for Our Time, and he cites a 19. And this was a book, an 80s look back, came out in 1979, correct?
Mm-hmm. January the 31st, 1979.
And it was like what happened during the 80s. So this was written around 1979, and Jeff Greenfield cites a Supreme Court decision which states that, quote, corporations may spend any amount of money to influence the outcome of public referenda, and that individuals may spend any amount of money to elect themselves to office. We take judicial notice of the fact that money talks. So, all right, it took 30 years to become a reality.
Right.
But this was satire, ho-ho, like this could happen. And then it did.
Yes, actually, that's absolutely true. I think you actually list many of the things that did actually come true in one way or another. Mm. And, of course, we had to wait 30 years for the Congress of Nuts, too. But we finally got that.
And the amicus vitae brief.
Right.
Again, unthinkable, but...
I think my favorite piece in that, though, was the Shroud of Elvis, which it was in that book, right? Yeah, it was. It was the Shroud of Elvis was discovered, I think, in that book. But anyway, I may be getting mixed up with the 90s look back. But one of the things that I also liked about the book was that you didn't, first of all, that you concentrated on the material, because the material is the one thing that has sort of been forgotten. And it shouldn't be, because, as you say, much of it holds up. And there was nothing like it before or since that I know of. I mean, I think certainly in magazine terms, very few magazines have ever done anything like what we did in the sort of heyday, the golden years, as we call them, of the Lampoon. I mean, you cite the Vietnamese Baby book, for example, which is a piece I actually had to make O'Donoghue dig out of his drawer. But that was a perfect... This was a book that was a baby book that was called The Vietnamese Baby Book, and it was a baby book in all its beautiful sugary saccharine little bows and kisses everywhere, except that the baby in question was one of the babies that had been killed or injured at My Lai. And so baby's first word was medic, and baby's first toy was a bandage, and so forth and so on. And it was a devastating piece of satire, actually, a genuine piece of satire.
And the thing about the Lampoon also that was interesting is that it was different from things that had gone before, like, say, for example, The Realist, because the production values were very good. It was not totally glossy, but the attention to detail and the, you know, Michael Gross in the art department, the artwork, so the parodies... All the details of parodies, even down to like sort of personal ads. Another one of these pressing articles. This is one I didn't put in the book, and now I'm kicking myself. In the Future issue, which was May 1970, there was a magazine set all the way in the future of May 1977, and it was like a Playboy magazine for computers.
Oh right, yeah.
And it has a picture of some sort of giant computer on the front, and it's written by computers, and so it has all these personal ads that has, you know, jokes about COBOL and Fortran in them, and this is total geek humor before there even was such a thing,
right.
But incredible attention to detail, and things always looked like whatever it was they were parodying, and I think that's one of the things that made it very different, and that's something that
I think actually that's the same dynamic that I'm talking about with satire. I mean, I don't think parody is the same as satire. Parody is when you when you take on the style and so forth, coloration and obsessions and so on of your target, whereas satire is what we've already defined. But it was a very strict discipline, and it was one which made us, I think, much sharper than we were given credit for. Because we insisted that everything, that you couldn't make fun, as I think Michael Gross said, you can't make fun of a postage stamp unless it's actually looks exactly like a postage stamp. And then it becomes literally 10 times funnier, which is why all those parodies, the Pet House was one of my favorites, with all these incredible sexy
puppies,
of cats,
puppies,
yes, with Vaseline on the lens and stuff. Just wonderful stuff. But it was really accurate. You know, all the little quirks of design and so forth were picked up on, the logo and Guccione and all that stuff.
So funny is that it was a professionalism to it, I think is what
Yes.
What is the point to it? And the other thing about satire in the classical sense, and this was, I think, one that the Lampoon wrestled with, because some of it did, some of it didn't. In the Vietnamese baby book, the classical definition aims to instruct, and amusement is a byproduct, you know, as opposed to aiming to amuse, and any instruction
is
a byproduct.
Yes, right.
And I think from what I gather, Lampoon, if you'd said you wanted to instruct, it would have been, oh, please. But, you know, again, some of the pieces were fueled by that urge to the corrective urge, and others, it was like, what? So would you say that was a dynamic that existed?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it was. And I think there's actually a funny kind of reflex that satirists have had in the modern era, mainly perhaps because of this worry about being called, you know, pretentious or whatever, but
serious.
Which is they always sort of discount or disown that intention. I mean, as I think you mentioned, the Beyond the Fringe people, who at least in English terms, started all this, were always saying we're not satirists. We're just sort of poking fun at things in a good-hearted way.
And I think Ken Tynan called them anti-reactionary without being progressive.
Yeah, but that was him being carping at them. But in fact, what they were doing, especially in the wonderful piece by Alan Bennett of a Church of England sermon, which is just extraordinary, was out and out satire. I mean, satire in the classic way. He takes on the character of his target and destroys it. And just in the same way, I think a lot of people at the Lampoon kind of were nervous about claiming that they actually had. I never was, frankly, because that was always my purpose, was to try and change things. I mean, in Father Joe, I explain how Father Joe was my Benedictine mentor. And I explain how I came out of Beyond the Fringe. I went in a monk, and I came out a satirist. And I said to myself, save the world through prayer? I don't think so. I'm going to save it through laughter. Mm. And you can see how effective it's been.
Yes, I was just thinking of that Peter Cook line. Yes, the satiric cabarets of the Weimar Republic that did so much to stop the rise of Nazi Germany.
Yes, exactly. Wonderful. I heard that story as coming from Second City, but I think maybe there's a little bit of lend-leasing going on there.
Oh, okay. It sounds more Peter Cook to me.
Anyway, I mean, I think, to come back to your original question, I mean, I think it seems to me extremely hard to do real satire on television. It doesn't matter how officially tolerant television gets. It ultimately, at the end of the day, there is always a corporate sponsor, or there is some kind of corporate presence behind it, because it can't function otherwise. And I think that's increasingly the case on the internet too. So that
I was going to ask you, do you think that that's one of the things also I look at, is how the media context affects. Things don't happen in a vacuum, and the media context affects the material, and that you see that in Saturday Night Live, that, you know, we go into that a lot, where they weren't, you know, it wasn't the sponsors came down and said, oh, you can't do that, but nevertheless, there's always a faint hint of this. And do you think that, as Michael Shamberg said, that once you, the production costs are so much lower now because of, you know, accessible technology, and because the distribution is so much more, there's so many more ways of distribution and fewer gatekeepers. Do you think that there is more kind of genuine satire out there as a result, or because they don't have these pressures you just mentioned?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, but that's obviously purely personal, because there is so much. There's just so much video and so forth out there that it's impossible to review at all. And I do think that you know, there are several things militating against it. One is that there are successful corporately owned or run so-called satire sites like Funny or Die and College Humor, which were neither of which are satirical, but both of which are sort of heavy-duty corporate enterprises. I mean, that's what they...
they assume that sort of tone, but their message.
Yes,
is
as I said yeah. once about Saturday Night, the sound but not the fury.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be a problem because they're kind of sucking all the oxygen out of the internet, if you like, all the satirical oxygen.
Except for the final edition.
Well, no, the final edition has no sponsors, and therefore, and also has no distribution. Mm. But we're gradually sort of building it up.
Not yet.
And I think the Onion, I think the Onion has a kind of, I love the Onion, and the Onion, when I first met them, were great enough and generous enough to say, we owe everything to the Lampoon, which was like the first time I'd ever heard anyone say that, which was in the late 90s.
Yeah.
And they said that's all we wanted to do, was to do something like the National Lampoon. And the Lampoon had sponsors, too. So, I mean, it's like there comes a point where...
It's always a trade-off.
Yeah. Mm. But I think in the Lampoon, there was a time, anyway, we just didn't care.
Yes.
And we were successful enough, like we were talking under the sponsors to our audience.
Well, that's what I thought was so interesting, is that that's what I said so interesting, that's why I stopped at the 80s, because then it becomes a commercial product.
Right.
We know what it is we're trying to do. We think we know who our audience is, and we're going to do something for audience. Whereas initially, Lampoon, you were writing for yourselves. But we like this, I like this, this like it.
Right,
and
that's right.
If the audience happens to like it, that's okay, and if they don't, who cares, which is an unusual attitude. Personally, I think those things that are most likely to really be hits, because it's people always like something fresh and like, I'm going to do it, I don't care. But, and all good rock bands, that's how they think. But that it did happen to work. It was time, place, luck, talent. But it's a rare confluence.
Mm-hmm.
Of circumstances,
sure.
And that's what I wanted to look at. Why did it work, and why then, as opposed to
right.
Here are these funny people. Oh, look, there they are being funny.
Yes, and I think you've very successfully created that sort of sense of time. But I also, as you say, I think one of the things that is tremendously fun and interesting and fascinating about this book, provided you have some minuscule modicum of historical sense and knowledge, is that a lot of this stuff holds up because it's the issues that were aborning in the 70s have not gone away, and nor have they been resolved.
Yeah, no, that's why this material is so, so strong. Some people, I've read some kind of say, there are no jokes in it, and I just like, how can they? But senses of humor are very individual. And I mean, I the jokes, my sense of humor is a bit dry to begin with, and I did try to be a bit subtle, because the last thing I wanted to do was like, oh, look, I'm really funny, too. That would have been like a terrible mistake.
Right.
I may have made them too subtle so that, they just completely miss several people. But I think you can't do it entirely. You cannot write a book about something like this entirely, in a chin-stroking
straight-faced
way, but I just, how can, and they, some people even said they're not even Lampoon jokes in it, and that's what I, how can you read the excerpts and not see that there are jokes there? It's a mystery to me.
That's why I think this book is, and it's not only, it's the last book standing when it comes to the Lampoon too, which is probably, I doubt if another book is going to come out about the Lampoon.
We hope not. There have been more than
we Lampooners certainly hope not. But it's I think one thing is interesting, which is worth stating before we finish, because I think that the one really big change that has happened in the last 20 years or so, 20 to 30 years, is that the rise of what I once called entrepreneurial comedy has made, meaning stand-up comedy, which has sort of fragmented the comedic world into literally thousands and thousands of voices, is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a collective kind of humor that in which there were definitely stars emerged, but even the first cast of Saturday Night Live, which was the last cast of the National Lampoon, was a collective.
This has been a special episode of Cheater and the Rude. Stick around for the final edition radio hour.